For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale.
I'm producer Robert Kirkwood, and coming up in today's show, Sini Glaister on her third novel, Growing Season, and Luanne Goldie on her second novel, Homecoming.
Listener Paul Milray reviews a classic detective novel, and Maribel Steele shares her short story, Imagining a Sunset Sky.
Plus a return to Sini Glaister for the books of her life. That's all coming up in today's show. Now, if you're listening to the show on the day it was released, this book came out yesterday. Sini Glaister is the co-founder of The Book People and the author of The Museum of Things Left Behind and last year's Mr. Doubler Begins Again. In her new book, Growing Season, after a life-saving operation leaves Sam unable to have children, could a rural cottage be the fresh start she needs? Or is she running away from her problems? And for her husband Danny, this was never part of the plan. The audiobook version is read by Kirsten Atherton.
Danny hadn't been sleeping, but a guttural screech had yanked him from his meditative state of rhythmic breathing to one of immediate alertness. He swung his legs out of bed and was now peering between the curtains into the darkness beyond, his heart thumping wildly in his chest.
"What the hell was that?"
he asked, his voice strained in the silence of the bedroom.
"What was what?"
asked Sam, sleepily beside him.
"Did you hear that noise? It sounded like someone's being murdered out there. I heard a scream. Did you hear it?"
Danny let the curtains drop and stumbled around the bed, feeling his way around a room that was still menacing in its unfamiliarity. He fumbled in the darkness for his dressing gown, unhooking it from the back of the door and wrapping it around him tightly. He returned to his watch post, perching himself on the side of the bed, and once again he pressed his face to the glass, squinting into the raven night.
Kirsten Atherton reading from Growing Season by Sini Glaister, who joined me via Zoom to tell me about the book.
Well, I've been very interested to see how people have been talking about the book in the run-up to publication. It's definitely been pitched as a love story. I am not convinced it's a love story, but it's really the story of a young married couple who are childless. I look in some detail at the difference between childlessness and child-free and a woman's right to be one or both. And it's also the book about the things we tell other people about ourselves and the things we choose not to tell.
From her prone position beside him, Sam answered him through a yawn.
"Probably just a fox. Or a cat, maybe. Or an owl. It could have been any one of the holy trinity of night noises." "Welcome to the countryside," she said, with an exaggerated yawn.
Danny didn't smile. He continued to peer into the dark.
"That was no fox. I know what a fox sounds like. A fox sounds like metal."
Sam, fully alert now, processed his logic and laughed, switching on the light.
"You idiot. Foxes don't sound like metal." "They do. They make a very distinctive sound. Turn the light off. I can't see a thing."
"You mean the sound of dustbins? Foxes make the sound of metal because you've only ever heard them rooting through a dustbin? Jesus, Danny, we got out of London just in time to rescue you." She turned off the light again and stared up at the dark ceiling above her, smiling. Danny, feeling vulnerable in his boxer shorts, kept his dressing gown on and flopped back on the bed beside his wife.
The young couple are Sam and Danny, and they both have quite a few issues that they're trying to process and cope with, and they use different mechanisms to overcome these issues. And eventually, through the help of a third party, learn to talk more openly to each other. So it's really about talking and listening and seeing the complete person.
Now, obviously, you wrote this before the current situation, but I think there's a certain resonance as we've all had to isolate together and perhaps couples are finding out a bit more about each other.
Oh, I think so. I think it will have been, in many respects, a really important time for people to spend an intense time together that might not have happened under any other circumstance. I think that can have its challenges. I think that can be very tricky. Mm. You know, quite often both people in a relationship or in a household are working, so they have their own separate lives. And I think this sort of enforced period of time where you're living under one roof can be very challenging, but also profoundly useful in terms of getting to know somebody more completely.
With Mr. Doubler as well, there is a sort of theme about making connections.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to me. And I might not have, when I started writing, I might not have realised how important it was to me, but the fact that these themes keep coming through, I think I'm fascinated, I think, by people's backstories. And it's very, very easy to make a quick assessment about somebody and to assume, you know, maybe they're not very nice or they're very rude or abrupt. And I think once you get to understand somebody's backstory, you can understand where they're coming from and why they might be the way they are. Certainly, that's a theme that I explored in depth in both Mr. Doubler and in Growing Season.
Now, at one point, Sam is writing as Libby. Did you find that weird as you were writing as Sam?
Yeah. Yes, it gets a bit meta. it really does. I think, again, it's something I've thought about a lot. When I was growing up, I was incredibly shy and my shyness was quite debilitating. But I found ways as I became a teenager, particularly through working, actually, and having to interact with colleagues, I found ways of coping with my shyness. And one of them was, without wanting to sound like I wasn't true to myself, was by adopting another persona. And that really, the first time I did that was when I worked behind a bar in a pub. And as a shy person, you get more unwelcome attention in that environment because people are sort of giving you a little bit more banter. Come on, cheer up, love, you know. And what you want to do is avoid that additional focus. So I found I could adopt the persona of a much more confident person for the period that I was behind the bar, so that I could blend in and not draw as much attention to myself. Mm. And I think we all do that. We can, you know, without leaving our true selves behind completely, I think we can find ways to embody a characteristic that helps us cope. So what Sam was doing really was writing as somebody else, writing the things she didn't quite dare say out loud, even to herself, by imagining what this other young woman might think about the subject. And by putting some distance between her and her feelings, she was able to commit those feelings to writing. As it turns out, of course, she couldn't say those things to her husband either. And it became increasingly important that actually she needed to just say the stuff out loud if she was going to save her relationship.
Now, we started with a clip of Kirsten Atherton reading from the book. Did you have any choice in the narrator?
She was highly recommended to me. My publisher has always been very considerate in terms of giving me a choice and letting me listen to the voice. It's something I actually find really, really hard to project for my own books. I think it's incredibly important, the voice of the reader. And I reading the audio reviews, you know, you see how much people focus on the reader as much as they do on the story. And of course that's important. It's like not mentioning an actor when you go to the theatre or watch film. So they can bring a huge amount. Personally, I'm very, very bad at listening to my own books. I love listening to audio books, but I'm absolutely awful at listening to my own. I have not been able to do it. So reading the reviews has been fascinating, and there's obviously such a passion for certain readers and voices and what they bring to the book. And I have total respect for the ability to do that and to add their own degree of personality and storytelling to my own story.
Yeah, no, you've sort of already answered this, but do you not fancy doing it yourself?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I definitely fall into the camp of as soon as I listen to my own voice played back. No, I can't. I just can't do it. I don't think I would be able to detach myself from the writer. And I think when I read it out loud, which I do, by the way, as a process of writing, my final read is always out loud because that's where I pick up those things that don't quite work. You know, to try and get into a reader's head, I read the book out loud so that I can hear it as a story. Mm. But which is a very, very useful editorial process to me. And I can't imagine not doing that because it really gets a much more nuanced sort of feel for how it will read in somebody else's imagination. But I can't, and particularly how dialogue lands, I think, is very important. You'll hear a word that character wouldn't say once you read it out loud. But I can't, as I say, I can't bear listening to my own voice. So no, I wouldn't be. There are people far more qualified than I am to do that. And believe me, they would do a much, much better job.
Now, the fact that it is in audio opens it up to a whole new audience who, for whatever reason, are print disabled. Is that important to you?
Yes, hugely important. I mean, it's an absolute... I think it's an honour for any author to have their book in audio and to imagine it reaching an audience wherever they are, however they read. So, yeah, it's very important to me. And lovely to be able to recommend it to people in that format as well. So I'm thrilled, absolutely thrilled.
She was laughing at him kindly, he knew, but he also felt idiotic. His heart was still pounding, which made him feel more exposed still. After a few minutes of agitated pause, he sat up again and returned to his vigil.
What else did you think it could be? A cat? What the hell do they do to their cats in the countryside? If it was a cat, it was definitely being strangled.
Sex. Cat sex. It's a very noisy business, apparently, and I don't think it is always consensual. Sam could see Danny's face reflected in the dark glass. She could see he was grimacing at the thought of noisy, bucolic, non-consensual sex.
What about owls? Is owl sex noisy too?
He asked, fearfully, as if not really wishing to know the answer. I somehow doubt it. I think if the noise was made by an owl, it was probably just seeing off a predator. Or perhaps it had just made a violent kill and is now swooping low across the fields with the small body of a dead rodent hanging limply from its outstretched talons.
Jesus Christ, Samantha! It's disgusting! If I'd known the countryside was so violent, I would have stayed in SW11.
Sidney Glaser's Growing Season, The Museum of Things Left Behind, and Mr. Doubler Begins Again are all available in the RNIB library and wherever you buy your books or audiobooks. And Sidney will be back at the end of the show for Books of Your Life.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show and your one-stop guide to book news, reviews and author interviews.
Homecoming is Luanne Goldie's second novel, and it follows hot on the heels of her outstanding debut, Nightingale Point, for which she's been longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. Homecoming explores race, family, and loss in a breathtaking story spanning two decades that moves between London and Kenya. Luanne joined me to tell me about both novels. Luanne, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with your most recent novel, Homecoming, which has just entered the RNIB Talking Books library. For anyone who's not familiar with it, could you just give us a bit of an overview?
Homecoming, the first chapter, it opens with a young man called Kiama. He's 18 years old, and he's going to meet this woman called Yvonne. She's a middle-aged Londoner. She's really into her career. She's single, she doesn't have any children, so we don't know too much about these two characters. We just see them at the start of the novel. They meet in this coffee shop, and Kiama, Arsabon to go to Kenya with him on a trip to find out something about his mother who passed away. And that's really how the story starts. And then it goes back over quite a long period of time, nearly 20 years. And you see how these two characters are linked to each other, how their histories are all twisted up with each other and why they have to do this trip to Kenya. So it takes that road trip concept, I guess, and puts it in a totally different space. That's what I wanted to do.
And it unravels the interconnected histories to discover how they're all connected.
Yeah, because it's about relationships, really, the book. You've got the romantic relationship that runs through the centre of the book, but also about this female friendship. And then this quite unusual friendship which develops between Yvonne and this teenage boy. Yeah, and just how relationships change over time. If you think over 20 years of your own life, how your relationships have changed with people, it's really interesting. So I just wanted to explore that in the book.
And Kiama's dad, Lewis, is a good man, but he's rather overprotective of his son.
Yeah, he is a good man. You see him go through quite a lot, says the dad. For the first, say, 8 or 9 years of his son's life, Lewis is not really around. He doesn't really know how to be a dad, or maybe he thinks he is being a good dad. He makes sure his son has great trainers and he takes him for haircuts, but he's not really there day to day. But then Kiama goes through a traumatic event in his childhood and Lewis really has to step up and become a better dad. So you see him transform quite a bit in the book. And yeah, he is rather protective over Kiama, but I think anyone with teenagers would probably say if you have a teenager who is quite wild, like Kiama has that streak in him, you would be protective over them. Having a child who's gone through quite a lot at a young age and then wants to go off and travel the world and party lots and take drugs. He talks about that in the book. So I think Lewis has lots of reasons to feel overprotective towards his son.
And Lewis himself has to learn to open up and love again.
Yes, he's been through so much and he's an interesting character. Some people who've read the book already have said at the start, we don't really like Lewis. We don't really know what he's about, but they fall for him throughout the book and want him to be able to open up himself to be in a relationship again. Yeah, he's interesting, but I think he deserves to be in a relationship again and to love again.
Where did you find the inspiration for this novel?
I had the character of Kiama in my head for quite a long time. I work with children. I'm a primary school teacher, and I'm always quite interested in how we in the profession react to children when we know they've gone through a traumatic event or if they've lost a parent. So I've had this in my head, and then I had Kiama in my head, but I knew I didn't want to write about a child so much. Most of the book, you see him as this 18-year-old, this young man. So I had him already, and then I had these students at university living in Harrow, and I knew they were best friends. And because this is how my process is, I have sort of the characters, and I don't really know how they all fit together. And I just started writing about the two students in Harrow, and then Kiama, and then the story started coming together. I saw they were linked. So yeah, I guess it was just from a few different things. And also the Kenya link, because half of the book is set in Kenya. I've been to Kenya probably long before I even started thinking about Kiama. I'd already been to Kenya and met lots of children there, and children who'd been through all different experiences, horrible experiences. But they were still kids, you know, and some of them were entering their teens, and children are just the same all over the world. To me, no matter what they've gone through, they all wanted to play and chat and ask about, how's your life different from my life? And yeah, just lots of different influences and experiences came together to make this book. And I hope when people read the book, it makes a bit more sense than how I'm explaining it now. You'll see how these things fit together. But I guess that's how writers work. Lots of different experiences come together to make the story.
Yes, that confluence is something that I think anybody who's enjoyed your debut novel, Nightingale Point, will recognise and relish in Homecoming. The way that different lives can gather round, well, any focal point, and that it's what we have in common that needs celebrating and examining.
Yeah, of course. That's real life. That's real life. It is a mixture of so many different things, messy things that don't always go together, or you feel they shouldn't go together. But, you know, there's only so much control we have over these things and who we're going to meet and fall in love with, or who our children grow up to become. Like you say, it's the same in Nightingale Point. All these different lives, different characters go through this event together, and it keeps them together for the rest of their lives.
Nightingale Point is also in the Talking Books library, and it is fantastically read by a cast of four narrators.
Elvis hates to leave his flat, as it is so full of perfect things, like the sparkly grey lino in the bathroom, the television, and the laminated pictures tacked up everywhere, reminding him how to lock the door securely and use the grill.
"Elvis!" Lena calls. "You want curry chicken or steak and kidney?"
Elvis does not answer. He is too busy hiding behind the sliding door that separates the kitchen and living room, watching Lena unpack the Weetabix, bread and strawberry jam. She unscrews the jar and puts one of her fingers inside, which is a bad thing to do because of germs, but Elvis understands because strawberry jam can be so tasty. This is the 19th day of Lena being Elvis's nurse. He knows this as he marked her first day on the calendar with a big smiley face. There are 14 smiley faces on the calendar and 5 sad faces, because this is when Lena was late. He puts the jar of jam in the cupboard and returns to the shopping bags, taking out a net of oranges. Elvis hates oranges. They are sticky and smelly. He had asked for tomatoes, but Lena said that tomatoes are an ingredient, not a snack, and that oranges are full of the kind of vitamins Elvis needed to make his brain work better and stop him from being a pest. Lena's face disappears behind a cupboard door, and Elvis watches as her pink-coloured nails wrap on the outside. He likes Lena's shiny pink nails, especially when her hair is pink too.
Nightingale Point, written by my guest, Luan Goldie. For those who don't yet know Nightingale Point, it is a book about a tragedy that happens in a housing estate in London, which is very reminiscent of the Grenfell fire. But it's actually a book you started working on 5 years before the events of 2017 in Kensington.
Yes, so Nightingale Point, it's set in East London in the mid-90s, but it's actually very loosely based on an event that happened in Holland in the early 90s. It's an event that a lot of British people have not heard about, but my husband is Dutch. We spend a lot of time in Holland. And if you grow up there, it's something that's tied into the national memory, this tragic event that happened to people that lived in a high rise. So Nightingale Point is a version of that event that happened in East London. And like you say, it was written before Grenfell happened, but there are some similarities. And at first, when the book came out, I was quite scared about people talking about the similarities, but they can't be avoided. They are there because the people went through a similar thing, and the aftermath is quite similar as well. Even though these things happened in different countries and in different decades, the responses were quite similar.
And many people find it more comfortable to examine a tragedy from the point of fiction rather than actually having to think of the real lives that were affected by real life events.
I guess so. Also in Nightingale Point, it is so much about those characters. It really, really zooms in on their experience of it. We can become quite detached, can't we, when we're watching the news and we're hearing figures about people that have been hurt and died from all these tragedies, especially at the moment. If you look at the figures from the pandemic every day, you're just immune to these numbers because they're so big and every day they keep coming. But then Nightingale Point, this small group of people, and you see how this tragedy really affects their day to day. You see them before, you see them when it happens, you see them after. And that was really important to me that you see them after, because they still have to get up in the morning and go to work or go to college. They still have to do all that normal stuff, just as anyone has to when they go through a horrific event and come out the other side. It's not just about, oh, my life, I've gone through this tragedy, I've gone through this awful thing. You still have to do your normal day-to-day life, and you see them laughing with each other a few days after the event and winding up their siblings and stuff like that, because life does go on. So yeah, I hope I've managed to show that side of it.
Well, the book has received a huge amount of acclaim, quite rightly so, and is longlisted for the Women's Fiction Prize, which is not the first prize that you've been a finalist for. I believe you won the Costa Short Story Award in 2017 as well.
Yeah, I did. That was my first big thing before I was even signed to a publisher. I entered the Costa Short Story Prize. I'd probably entered it a few years before as well and not got anywhere. But I really had a story that I'd worked on for a long time. It was very polished. And yeah, amazingly, I won the short story prize. And it was brilliant for me because I had this novel that I thought was finished, and I was trying to get publishers to look at it, and it wasn't really happening. And then when I won the short story prize, it changed everything for me. It was amazing.
The teacher in you would say that this is a reward for all the hard work and preparation that you've put in.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. Yeah, it was a long time. I've been writing for such a long, long time. So I was so pleased to win that short story prize. I was so pleased to just be a finalist in it, really, because you get to go to this amazing big party in central London. And for me, that was already enough. And then to win it was like, wow. And then everything seemed to happen quite quickly after that, signing the first publishing deal with HarperCollins for Nightingale Point. And then it was like, wow, Nightingale Point is out and everyone was reading it. And yeah, the reviews were brilliant. It all seemed to happen really fast from there onwards.
Are your pupils very proud of you?
They don't know. I mean, I teach mostly year one and year two, so my children are really young. They don't understand it at all. Some of the parents have cottoned on and they ask me about it. But yeah, the children are very young. They know I love books and I like writing. But at that age, they don't really get it. It doesn't make a difference to them that I'm a published author.
Now, your first two novels have both been set in London, at least partially. However, I know that you are a Scot, and I was wondering whether you have plans to set a novel in Glasgow, which I believe is your home city.
Yeah, I would love to. I would really, really love to do that. I love Glasgow. I only lived there till I was four, but most of my family do still live there. And whenever we go back, I just love it. I'd love to set a novel there, but I've not managed to even set a short story there yet. I don't think I can quite feel it enough to write it. And even though I can hear the way people talk in my head, I've not been that successful in capturing it when I write. But I think I just need to spend more time there, maybe just be completely immersed in it. But I'm waiting for it to hit me, an idea or... Yeah, it is frustrating because it's something I really want to do but just haven't been able to yet.
I'm interested that you say hearing the voices in your head. Your dialogue is very vibrant and really lends itself to being narrated in an audiobook. Do you start with the dialogue and build the scenes around?
Always. Dialogue. When I do a first draft of a novel, it's often just dialogue. Because that's what I hear. Well, because I see the characters, so I know how they look and how they're moving, how they behave, but I can really hear them talking. So often, I know with Nightingale Point, when I started it, the first draft I have of it is 50,000 words of just conversations. And then I had to build all the plot and everything else around it because I could just hear them so, so clearly. So when we did the audiobook of Nightingale Point, I went into the recording of some of it, and it was amazing to hear the actors bring it to life, and it sounded even better than how I'd heard it in my head when I started writing it. Such a strange experience.
Did you have a chance to attend the recordings for Homecoming Or did lockdown get in the way?
Yeah, well, we did some Zoom auditions to cast for Kiama. So I was involved in those, and that was brilliant because it's quite difficult, actually, with the audiobooks, especially with Nightingale Point, because it has those sort of quite specific accents in it. You've got your teenagers from East London. When they were starting to cast for the book, the publishers found it quite difficult to find the right people, basically. I guess people who read for audiobooks, it's quite a small pool of talent, and they didn't really have anyone in that pool that could do those characters authentically. So we worked with an acting school in East London called the E15 School to cast for the characters of Tristan and Malachi, who are teenage black boys from a council estate. And then with Homecoming, we did the same to cast for Kiama because we did want it to be authentic. So it's a new actor. He's just graduated this summer, actually. He's called Tommy Oldroyd. Yeah, so this is his first big job out of acting school. He's a young guy. He's from the borough of Barking and Dagenham, which is actually where my school is. So it's great.
The coffee shop is one of a chain, but this particular branch seems to have lost its way. The tables are filthy. The pleather seats are burst in places, and two men sit closest to the counter, openly making their way through a six-pack of supermarket croissants. Yvonne finds an empty table next to the toilets. The armrest is spotted with dried milk. It's the kind of dirt that signals neglect. It unnerves her. The walls are lined with photographs of generic Italy, wicker baskets of tomatoes, mopeds, skinny women in large sunglasses drinking espressos at pavement cafes. The door opens and a homeless woman emerges, bulging carrier bags at her side, smelling of urine. Yvonne doesn't want to be here. Deep down, she hoped he would cancel, was almost waiting for it, but when he texted her in the morning, it was to confirm this address and time. He's late. Maybe he won't come at all. Then she sees him on the other side of the glass door, taller than she'd imagined, far from the gangly 8-year-old he was when she last saw him. His hair is long and sits in a curly mass on the top of his head. He's wearing a pale pink sweatshirt with the sleeves rolled up, his arms marked with random tattoos. He's a man now, completely unfamiliar. But as he spots her and squints, she sees it's him. It's Kiama. Her hand goes up, but she feels too stunned to smile as he makes his way over. Hi. He hovers near the table. She stands up. Hello, Kiama. It's awkward, but she feels grateful that the furniture blocks the hug the situation requires. He scratches at his hair. Wow, this is crazy. Yes, she laughs, nervous. So weird to see you again.
Luanne Goldie, thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Oh, thank you. It's been great.
Both Homecoming and Nightingale Point are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
Adapting to life-changing events is tough, as more people than ever are discovering. One thing that really helps is having a guidebook to tell you what to expect and to give you some top tips. Meribel Steele is a writer, broadcaster and mother of four who lives in Melbourne, Australia. Her new book, Blindness for Beginners, is a wonderfully upbeat guide to adapting to life with sight loss. It's packed with sound, practical advice on how to meet the challenges when your world has changed. And Meribel's writing brims over with honesty, humour and joy. It's truly a book for our times that can help everyone adjust to the changed circumstances. The audiobook version will be out soon on Audible, and I'm delighted to say that Meribel has given RNIB Connect Radio permission to broadcast some of the stories it contains. So sit back and enjoy Alice Herman's narrating Imagining a Sunset Sky by Meribel Steele.
I was looking upwards towards a cloudy sky, the sun setting like a painting. Obviously, though, most of the 6 million cone cells that are supposed to detect colour in my eyes were not conveying reliable messages to the organ of sight. I could sense the brain becoming impatient as signals via the optic nerve were not being transmitted quickly enough. Brain asked my eyes, "What colour is the sky?" My eyes gazed at the sky more intensely, trying hard to guess the colour. Well, at this time of dusk, logically, it should be a shade of deepening blue, right? My brain likes logic, and in a few nanoseconds, it scanned my childhood memory bank to recall all the blue hues I had stored there. Like the painter Monet, I was eager to capture a sense of light dancing across the vast canvas of the skyline. It was then that I asked, am I seeing through vision-impaired eyes, or am I perhaps seeing through the logical deductions of the brain? I came to the conclusion it was a mixture of both. The internal dialogue shifted to ponder what colour had begun to blanket the evening sky as it turned from a light something to a darker something. I was content to be seeing the whatever it was before my eyes, amused by the relaying of signals and mixing of colours in the brain. My mind chose logical deduction from other body sensitivities too. If the current of air had travelled over my sun-warmed skin, the likelihood would be that a summer's day was shedding her glow, and my eyes could imagine warm shades of vivid pink, crimson yellow, or orange chrome. But the mildness of the day could have easily suggested that the sky was a mixture of cool grey swirling with tinges of mauve purple. As I wondered, a much darker shadow caught my attention from skyline to fence line. It was the deep green blob I knew to be the Australian blackwood tree. I could see the tree's image as a tall and wide dark something, towering up to the night sky, casting a majestic shadow over our garden. The distant sound of a light aircraft gliding across the sky distracted sensitive hearing. I tilted my head towards the sound, pointing my audio antennae, like hobbit ears, to track the stereo effect, from far left to the centre of the sky, and away to the far right. The staccato rhythms of the insect chorus reached a deafening crescendo and dominated the sounds in the night air. The sky had shifted through many shades in a short time, and my brain asked my eyes one more question. Do you remember seeing the evening stars as a little girl? My internal dialogue between heart and eyes replied, vaguely, but I'm happy to imagine them again. Brain, tell me, what does the night sky look like?
Alice Herman's narrating Imagining a Sunset Sky by Marybelle Steele. The recording was produced by Harry Williamson at Spring Studios in Melbourne, and it's taken from Marybelle's forthcoming book, Blindness for Beginners. For more information about Marybelle, check out her website, marybellesteele.com. And you can find an interview with Marybelle by downloading episode 163 of Read On, the audiobook show, from your favourite podcast provider.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Sini Glaister for the books of our life, it's back to Red Sail, this time with a much better microphone.
In March this year, Paul Milray contracted COVID-19. Up till then, the 63-year-old had enjoyed a fit and healthy life, and was even a fully qualified open-water diving instructor in his spare time. The virus left him in intensive care for 6 weeks, where he suffered two major strokes as a result of uncontrollable blood clotting. For several days, his life lay in the balance, but happily he pulled through and is now on the long road to recovery. However, one of the strokes has affected his sight and his ability to read. Always a voracious reader, Paul is now exploring the world of audiobooks and has agreed to record some reviews for us. So, over to you, Paul.
Scales of Justice by Niall Marsh, read by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Nurse Kettle mounted her bicycle and began to coast down Watts Lane. On her left appeared the quickset hedge of Jacob's cottage. From the far side came the voice of Mr. Octavius Danbury Finn.
"Adorable," Mr. Danbury Finn was saying. "Queen of delight! Fish!"
He was answered by the trill of feline voices. Nurse Kettle brought herself to anchor at the gate. "Good evening," she said. There was Mr. Danbury Finn in his Elizabethan garden giving supper to his cats.
This is the 18th work by Niall Marsh featuring Chief Detective Inspector Roderick Alleyne, and it's clearly a writer at the peak of her powers. The characters are well presented and the plotting is crisp. It begins with a wonderfully named Nurse Kettle cycling through the village and giving us an overview of what it looks like and where people are. But soon this idyllic scene is revealed to be hiding dark secrets. And one of those leads to the death of Colonel Carteret, a retired military man fond of his fishing. Carteret has been asked by the local lord to publish the true story of the lord's wartime exploits. Not bravery, but in fact treason. Treason which did not lead to the lord's disgrace, but led to the death of a younger man. Very quickly we're introduced to the key characters in this book. Danbury Finn, who's a cat lover and fisherman. Mrs. Kitty Carteret. Something out of sorts here. Slightly louche and enjoys her drink. A similar drink-sodden character, Commander Syce, and the rest of the Lacklander family as well as the Lord, including the majestic Lady Lacklander. The book perfectly divides into three, which corresponds to the number of discs. The first sets out the agenda, sets out the characters, and tells you where to go. The second has the murder and the arrival of Alleyne. The third has the resolution after a series of false starts. Now, I happen to like fishing, so that was an extra reason to like this book. But just to be clear, if you don't like fishing, it doesn't matter. This was a really entertaining read. And even though it was published in 1953, it's remarkably fresh. It's far from uncritical of the upper classes. Apparently, this was the author gradually turning against those upper classes. But she's clearly on top of her game as a writer. And Benedict Cumberbatch, what can you say? His reading is beautiful. He brings the characters to life and he keeps you engaged throughout. Now, when I listen to a book, I don't just like to enjoy it, I like to learn something. And I learned two things here. One, each trout has a different design on it, and each design is unique. And the second, I learned how to pronounce Mayo.
Scales of Justice by Niall Marsh, narrated by Benedict Cumberbatch, is available commercially. And there is also a wide range of Niall Marsh novels in the RNIB Talking Books library.
Now it's back to Sini Glaser for the books of her life. Now, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I read voraciously as a small child. Absolutely, it was, you know, where I disappeared for, you know, refuge and respite and more and more resolution later on. But from the earliest memory, I think I would credit actually Alison Uttley's Little Grey Rabbit books as a very, very young reader. I know those were the books that my mother most successfully bribed me with, and I would read them over and over again. And I did find them, a couple of them, strangely terrifying. Some very unpleasant weasel activity in those books, and I'm still very fearful of weasels. But I loved them, and I really, they're the first books I remember owning as possessions and absolutely adoring and wanting to read them again and again. But I never really stopped reading after that. So I was very fortunate to have access to lots of books. My parents were big readers, but I also have ensured that I've surrounded myself with books my whole life.
Wise Owl woke up and opened the door a crack.
Go away. I don't want anything,
he said when he saw Hare.
Go away. I'm asleep.
He shook his head violently, and his nightcap fell off and floated down to Hare.
Thank you, sir, said Hare.
Mrs. Hedgehog said that Fuzzy Peg's smock was dirty, and she would be very glad if Grey Rabbit would wash it. Mouldy Warp asked Hare if Grey Rabbit would wash his best scarf. The Speckledy Hen sent her green sunbonnet, and Mrs. Rat gave Hare her apron. Everybody was glad. Little Grey Rabbit was going to have a real wash day, and there was a scatter of little feet bearing garments for the wash tub. Grey Rabbit put her own handkerchiefs and nightgown and blue apron in the wash, and Squirrel brought her yellow dress. Hare warmed the water and carried it outside and poured it in a tub. Everything was ready, but there was no soap. High and low they hunted, under the table, in the woodshed. At last, Grey Rabbit found it in the flour bin, where Hare had left it on baking day. Squirrel ran up the apple tree and tied the clothesline to a branch. Then she ran up the pear tree and fastened the other end. Grey Rabbit stood at the wash tub, which Hare had placed among the daisies. She rubbed and scrubbed and dipped each little garment and soaped and rinsed them till they were clean. Then she tossed them into the clothes basket, and Hare and Squirrel carried them to the stream. They dabbled them in the clear water, shook them, and threw them up in the air like balls.
Alison Udley's Little Grey Rabbit series are available from RNIB Library, including Washing Day, as read by Pauline Munro. Now, is there a book on a rainy day that you'd happily sit down and reread?
To be honest, I haven't started rereading. I still have so much I want to read that I haven't yet read, but I do have a list of books I am looking forward to rereading. And you know, that's a very distinct category of book, isn't it? The ones that you would turn back to again and again. Certainly as a teenager and young adult, I reread a lot. I think the books I'm most looking forward to rereading, it's a quartet actually, it's Eleanor Ferrante's Neapolitan series. Because there are four and each is quite a lengthy book, I would be very happy to turn to page one of book one again the minute I finished the last page of book four. I found them profoundly moving. I thought the writing was absolutely beautiful. They're so rich in detail. And I'm not sure anyone has, for me, caught that feeling of growing up as accurately as Eleanor Ferrante has in those books. So yeah, they would definitely be at the top of my pile. But then I've got so many favourite books. I keep book lists in my head all the time. Books I love the most, books I recommend the most, books I would reread the most. So I'm actually looking forward to that, starting some of my favourite books over again.
This morning, Reno telephoned. I thought he wanted money again, and I was ready to say no. But that was not the reason for the phone call. His mother was gone. Since when? Since 2 weeks ago. And you're calling me now? My tone must have seemed hostile. Even though I wasn't angry or offended, there was just a touch of sarcasm. He tried to respond, but he did so in an awkward, muddled way, half in dialect, half in Italian. He said he was sure that his mother was wandering around Naples as usual. Even at night? You know how she is. I do, but does 2 weeks of absence seem normal? Yes. You haven't seen her for a while, Elena. She's gotten worse. She's never sleepy. She comes in, goes out, does what she likes. Anyway, in the end, he had started to get worried. He had asked everyone, made the rounds of the hospitals. He'd even gone to the police. Nothing. His mother wasn't anywhere. What a good son. A large man, 40 years old, who hadn't worked in his life, just a small-time crook and spendthrift. I could imagine how carefully he had done his searching. Not at all. He had no brain, and in his heart he had only himself. "She's not with you?" he asked suddenly. His mother, here in Turin? He knew the situation perfectly well. He was speaking only to speak. Yes, he liked to travel. He had come to my house at least a dozen times without being invited. His mother, whom I would have welcomed with pleasure, had never left Naples in her life. I answered, "No, she's not with me." "You're sure?" "Reno, please. I told you she's not here." "Then where has she gone?" He began to cry, and I let him act out his desperation, sobs that began fake and became real. When he stopped, I said, "Please, for once behave as she would like. Don't look for her."
"What do you mean?"
"Just what I said. It's pointless. Learn to stand on your own 2 feet and don't call me again either." I hung up.
Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan series, all 4 books, are available from the RNIB Library as read by Madeline Brawley. Now, is there a book you've recently read? Doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
Yeah, I mean, I've read some amazing books recently, absolutely fantastic books, but the one I keep finding myself recommending because it was so fresh and so new and so shocking was My Sister the Serial Killer by Oyinkan Braithwaite. And it's an incredibly powerful book. And I think we were talking a little earlier about how it's easier to empathize with somebody once you know their backstory. This is a very extreme example of that. It's very dark, it's comedic, it's quite upsetting in places, but then you begin to understand why this young woman in Lagos does what she does when you realize what she's been subjected to as a child. And I found that it was very funny. I did laugh out loud, but it was also incredibly powerful. And I loved her writing, absolutely loved it. Very, very short chapters, very quick moving dialogue. And I raced through it and immediately could not wait for people I know and love and respect to read it also.
When she informed me they were coming, I hustled Ayola to our father's study. Empty of books and memorabilia, it was just a musty space with a table, an armchair and a rug. It was gloomy, so I pulled back a curtain. The bright light revealed dust motes floating all around us.
"Why did you bring me here?
We need to talk."
"Here?"
There were no distractions. No bed for Ayola to lie on, no TV to draw her eyes, and no material to fiddle with. "Sit down." She frowned, but complied. "When did you see Femi last?"
"What? You know when I..."
"Ayola, we need to be ready for these questions." Her eyes widened, and then she smiled. She leaned back. "Don't lean back. You don't want to look too relaxed. An innocent person would still be tense. Why did you kill him?"
She stopped smiling. Would they really ask that?
They may want to trip you up.
I didn't kill him.
She looked me straight in the eye as she said it.
Yes, I remember now. I didn't have to teach her to maintain eye contact. She was already a pro. The younger policeman blushes.
How long had the two of you been dating, ma?
1 month.
That's not very long.
She says nothing, and I feel a sense of pride.
But he wanted to break up with you.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to break up with you. Abby, was it the other way around?
I wonder if Ayola was right. That in my anger, I had overlooked the unlikelihood that a man would willingly leave her side. Even now, we all pale beside her. She is dressed simply in a grey blouse and navy trousers. She has applied nothing but eyebrow pencil to her face, and she isn't wearing jewellery, but it makes her look younger and fresher. When she gives the policeman an occasional smile, she reveals her deep dimples. I clear my throat and hope that Ayola gets the message.
My Sister, the Serial Killer by Oinkan Braithwaite is available in the RNIB Library as read by Waruchi Opia. Sini, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the RNIB Connect Radio listeners. I know as a bookseller that can't have been easy to pick just three.
Oh, no. I mean, I could talk about my favourite books forever. So, but thank you for giving me the opportunity, and I very, very much look forward to hearing what people think of Growing Season.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week, or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at Talking_books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.